your kids could get free or low-cost health coverage from Medicaid or CHIP. Even if you've applied before, they may be eligible now. Kids up to age 19 are covered for checkups, vaccines, dentist visits, hospital care, and more. And if they already have Medicaid or CHIP, remember to renew every year. Visit InsureKidsNow.gov or call 877-KIDS-NOW. Paid for by the U.S. Department of Health and Human Services.
This is the story of the one. As head of maintenance at a concert hall, he knows the show must always go on. That's why he works behind the scenes, ensuring every light is working, the HVAC is humming, and his facility shines. With Grainger's supplies and solutions for every challenge he faces, plus 24/7 customer support, his venue never misses a beat. Call quickgrainger.com or just stop by. Grainger, for the ones who get it done.
To the Umbrella Hour. The Umbrella Hour is hosted by Dr. Om, clinical sexologist, and Xander Keg, licensed clinical social worker. The Umbrella Hour features insightful, provocative, and inspiring interviews that examine the lives of LGBT people from diverse vantage points. I'm now going to turn this over to Xander, who will introduce our guest. And thank you for joining us.
Thank you, Dr. On. Well, I have the distinct pleasure and honor of introducing our guest today. Our guest today is Dr. Donovan Ackley III. He's a full-time research coordinator and program specialist for the San Diego State University Research Foundation. He's currently working on community-based interventions to improve the sexual health and well-being of sexual and gender minorities in the Improving Health Outcomes Through Technology lab in the psychology department. He also contracts independently to provide workforce training for the Cultural Responsiveness Academy in the California Department of Child Welfare Services and in the County of San Diego Behavioral Health Services. He is the current chair of the County of San Diego Behavioral Health Services Older Adult Council. Previously a full professor and department chair in religion and philosophy, his scholarly work and publications focus on peer support, including one of SAMHSA's guides for people living with HIV and AIDS, and on the intersections of spiritual resilience, gender and sexuality, and religious trauma. In addition to his PhD in religion and philosophy, he's certified as a peer support specialist and trauma recovery yoga instructor. Welcome to the show, Donovan.
Thank you.
What an interesting background. You're a busy man.
I've had to be. Yeah. I had another certification. I guess I didn't keep it in there, but I'm also a certified alcohol and drug counselor. So,
all right.
Yeah.
Okay.
Kind of ties some of those things together.
Absolutely. That's wonderful. Donovan and I first met in 2013. It was via email. At the time, I was looking for authors. So I had a call out for authors for an anthology project that I was working on for a book that became Manning Up. Transsexual Men on, you can find it at transgresspress.org. But we first met because Donovan is a contributing author to that book. Mm-hmm. So we met via email back in 2013. And Donovan reminded me of this before we hit record. We met in person for the first time in 2017 at the Being Brave conference that was run by Trans Faith, which is an organization that exists here in the United States. And that was in person in San Diego, California, where I was living and he was also living. So I'm really glad that you reminded me of that event. In your bio, you mentioned being involved in spirituality and embodied practices. And I'd love to know how, like, your history with studying religion, teaching religion, and then going into more spirituality-oriented communities. And what do you mean by embodied practices?
Thank you. Well, even before I came out, I was always drawn to yoga, for example. And I was a Christian pastor for a while, but I want to backtrack and say I wasn't raised in that tradition. My parents didn't call themselves hippies, but they were hippie adjacent, I would say. Definitely countercultural in the sense of like that sort of love and harmony and equality, working for civil rights, being very open to all kinds of different practices. So I was raised with the opportunity to practice and meet people from a lot of different traditions. So that's continued on into my life to practice seated meditation and chanting. And as I said, yoga, not as a fitness thing so much as a way of connecting with all that is. So when I did become a Christian, I went on to be a theologian for quite a while. My PhD focus was in theology. That can be very cerebral. And I was a theology professor. I was an ordained minister, all these things. So I was called into, it wasn't that I was exactly pursuing those paths intentionally, but I got invited to do those things. And so I grew up very, very poor. And I'm only bringing that up to say the scholarships that were made available to me were to pursue that type of education. And so it was sort of a path I meandered down, but I didn't want to be on such a narrow path, I guess I would say. For me, being in the academic life and doing the lecturing and the publishing and the written reflection, reading a lot of books. I mean, theology is really treatises and teaching that and that way of preaching. I was assigned female at birth. The Catholic Church doesn't ordain women, so I had no choice but to be in a Protestant tradition, meaning not Catholic. You know, it's a very word-focused tradition. It's generally less liturgical than the Catholic tradition. However, my personal practice was much friendlier to, as some people call it, smells and bells. So I liked the kinds of traditions in terms of my own personal practice that didn't want me around, even as a person assigned female at birth, still living as a woman. I might have digressed, but a lot of this had to do with the intersections of gender and how even being in a woman's body, the limitations on who can be in which space because of the sex or gender that they're assigned or because of who their partner is and the sex or gender of their partner. That was something that I was always butting up against in one way or another. And even when I applied for my PhD, the book I pitched in my essay to apply to graduate school, I said, I want to write a liberation theology of the body. I was always drawn to liberation theology. I don't know if y'all know what that is, but it comes from base communities, grassroots communities. It started in Latin America. And so I was very drawn to this, having grown up poor myself. What we can teach and know about our tradition really comes from the communities that practice it. And most of those people around the world are very poor. So they're not the people with the PhDs sitting in a university office. And so doing theology from the ground up, from the people who practice and how they live their faith, that to me always made the most sense. Even in my early 20s, I wanted to be very body focused in my theology. As it turned out, that path of prayer and meditation and fasting and reading from the world traditions and being very focused on what does it mean to be in this kind of body, it really led me down a path of becoming aware. I didn't really choose this. I'd been living with depression for a long time. I was living with a lot of physical symptoms right before I came out. Undiagnosed intersex condition, or at least it wasn't disclosed to me. And I was put on female hormones when I was 15 to just kind of regularize. I was starting to naturally virilize. I wasn't having regular periods and things like this. So the treatment in those days was put someone on estrogen and progesterone treatments because I was assigned female at birth. So to feminize me more. And I don't want to digress into all that, but the point is it was very depressing to me. It was very disorienting to me. It made me physically ill. People with the condition I have don't process female hormone, even the naturally occurring ones, let alone the dangerously high doses they had to give me to feminize me. They weren't normal doses. I was struggling with a lot of different things. And at some point when I was 47, the DSM-5, the American Psychiatric Association, I believe it is, changed their diagnostic criteria for some of the symptoms I was having. And I was told that I had gender dysphoria and that I was taken off all of the psych meds that I had been plied with to make me normal. Not long after that, I was taken off. I just stopped taking the female hormones I'd been on. And by the time I was 50, I was diagnosed with the intersex condition that I've had symptoms of ever since my birth, when my parents thought I was a boy. So all that to say, this focus on the body, it was very challenging. And when all those things changed in 2013 and I was reassigned from you're a woman with bipolar disorder to no, you're a trans man with gender dysphoria. And then 3 years later to actually you have an underlying, it doesn't really undermine either of those previous things, I guess, but you have an underlying intersex condition and it's not really a mental illness at all. It's just an endocrine system difference. So all of that brought a lot of people people in my life who were religious had a lot of big feelings about those changes. And it caught me off guard because I'd been a very faithful minister and a very devoted theologian and very active in my communities of faith and in my professional communities. And they'd known I was dying. You know, I was dying at one point from right before I came out from these all these symptoms. I couldn't keep food down for a year and a half. I was very, very ill. So when I stopped the female hormones and the psych meds, my health became very robust. To have these changes go on in my body as a person of faith, it's really taken all these embodied practices to help me be okay in my body.
I don't think you're going on and on. I think our world is complicated and it's very important that is understood because I think it isn't. And so the fact that you're reviewing, you've been through, somebody is probably relating to that.
Thank you. Yeah. And one way I was drawn to religion from my youth was to sort of escape this body that I did have dysphoria. And I didn't understand why I thought I was a little boy and I was going to grow up to be a man and why I was told, well, you can't pee standing up and, you know, all these other things. I started to be sort of a disembodied brain and a disembodied spirit. I went into an academic life so that I wouldn't have to really be connected to my body. Again, don't want to trigger anybody. Well, I was a sexual assault survivor. Again, don't want to trigger anybody, but there were things going on in my home and in my school and for many, many years. So that was another reason I wanted to check out of my body in some ways. These embodied practices that I focus on now, especially since I've come out, they have deep roots in my earlier life, but they're more important to me now as an intersex person and as a trans man. And as a same-sex attracted man, you know, I would call myself gay, but I find that cisgender gay men don't read me as a gay man. So I'm trying to be open to that and just say same gender attracted. But in any case, it's a body that gets shamed for a lot of different reasons. And it's a body that doesn't seem to have a place in most faith communities, even the really open-minded ones like some of the yoga meditation communities that I would have thought would be open-minded. Things like, you know, you're a man who's given birth and you want to talk about that. I mean, not that I want to talk about it all the time, but sometimes it's relevant and it's a deep part of my spiritual experience that I carried and gave birth to two people and I nursed, you know, I spent 3 years of my life lactating. You know, those are very deep, profound experiences of embodiment. And I don't know that anybody else needs to have real big feelings about them. I mean, my kids sometimes do in a good way. Like we have this bond, but to not be able to be in gatherings of other people doing embodied practices because my body is one that makes them uncomfortable, just not because of anything I do or say, just because I exist. That's something that I spend a lot of time in walking meditation and other kinds of embodied practices. My body has to be central to my faith because my body is so othered and so shamed and so excluded, specifically by the communities of practice that whose sacred teachings and practices I find most meaningful. So I can either tear myself down and hide, or I can embrace this different body and say, oh, what can I learn from folks about how to live in a body, doesn't matter what kind of body it is, and be part of the world that we live in.
I just wanted to mention the level of sensitivity, just mentioning that you are a sexual assault survivor. It takes someone like yourself to be able to do the work that you do with other survivors, because again, it's a population that can't talk about things in the general scheme of life. And there's a lot of stigma and shame attached to that. And for little people to experience what they do and then to grow up to continue to carry that shame, it's a lot of emotional investment. And I think that just listening to you, you're being so authentic. I wish more people were, and I know they can't always be, and I get that. I'm glad you're doing what you're doing and not being too mindful about following an agenda.
Thank you.
I'm really happy that you walked us through that journey because I think that it's helpful for people to be able to see. It's like who we become in life, there's a rhyme and a reason for it. Right. And so you are able to experience all of those trials and tribulations throughout all that time in your life. and still come to a place of embodiment, right? Against all odds, right? If you think about it. So that says something about you, right? Whether that's resilience or perseverance or moxie, you know, whatever it is, you know, hard-headedness, my parents probably would have said about me having come to a similar place. Something that you were talking about with the sexual trauma, I'm also a survivor of sexual trauma. Mine was military related, so it's called military sexual trauma. And one of the issues that has come up for me, not currently, but in the past, and I've talked with other trans men, if you're a trans man, a survivor of sexual assault, it's not appropriate for us to go to the women's survivor groups. And I don't always feel like I can, I'm not on par with the men because they were targeted for a very different reason. Their bodies were treated in a very different way that my body was treated. At the Department of Veterans Affairs, they do have military sexual trauma services. There's a military sexual trauma coordinator at every single VA hospital, but they tend to be very focused on female veterans, which make up a really small percentage of the veteran population, and also a smaller percentage of military sexual trauma survivors, because most people in the military are men. And so there's a huge number of male military sexual trauma survivors. Have you been able to find a place, a people, a group of people? I know online there's Male Survivor, which is a website, but it's like I haven't yet found a community or a resource that would be specifically a welcoming place for somebody like us.
Mm. I'm really glad you brought that up. Two things. I'd have to say yes and no to that. Yes, in that I know where those communities are. I'm very grateful to share with you RAINN, RAIN, and FORGE. They have jointly done workshops I've attended multiple times on gender integrated care for sexual assault survivors. And they are wizards at it. I mean, they're just so genius about it because they are coming at it from a trans specific perspective, a trans led perspective. So it really is fully gender inclusive. They just are so skillful at bringing forward how do we do this in a culturally competent way to really address a person and include a person of any gender who has experienced this and build community among people who have experienced this across gender when many of us who have experienced that have certain feelings, energy, maybe don't even feel safe around maybe a specific gender. It's tricky work to do and noticing when are times when people need to be in safe spaces. I won't try to summarize it because they've done great work on it and you can find their webinars and their toolkits and stuff online. And they have peer support groups. Some of them have in-person support groups around the country. I know they're good. The reason I would say no is just because I haven't found a need to gather with other so far. I mean, I shouldn't say I haven't found a need. That might not be the right way to say it. I've had other more pressing needs. And I've done a lot of that work since I was a small child. I've done work on that individually in therapy. So I'm not saying I don't have more to do. I know there's always more layers. However, there have been just other things that have been much more pressing that I've needed to address.
I'll reach out to Michael too, Michael Munson, the executive director of Forge, because I know that Forge has federal contracts and I'm going to ask him if he's ever been approached by or has any interest in approaching the Department of Veterans Affairs, because I really think that their national military sexual trauma program could use a training like they developed with RAIN.
I think you're going to love what you find. It's amazing. They're doing amazing work.
That's wonderful.
Yeah.
So I have never heard of trauma recovery yoga. So is this something that's newer or like how did you get involved with that and what does it look like? What's its purpose?
That's a good question. Well, I got involved with it because when I came out at that point, I had been a full-time college professor for 15 years. I thought my career path was well established and I was planning to persist in that career until retirement. Now, when I came out, they decided they could no longer have me on campus and it was too controversial and blah, 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 blah. So that's relevant in that I found myself unemployed, unable to find employment in my field, and I didn't know what else to do. My teaching evaluations were already very, very good. I mean, when I was looking at what do I have to offer, it seemed like continuing to try to teach in some capacity made the most sense because it's where my experience, skills, and references lie at that time, at least. So I could see that I couldn't teach Christian theology anymore. Christians were having none of it at least at that moment. Other religious studies departments would hire me as an adjunct, but nobody was looking to hire someone who had been at a Christian school for so long in an interfaith or secular department. And, you know, I can understand that. They didn't know who I was. My point being, having done yoga since I was 6 years old, I thought, well, this is something I have done my whole life. And, you know, maybe I could teach this. The first new credential I got was as a yoga instructor. That was very difficult as a very obviously visibly trans person. At that time, my documents didn't match. I was very androgynous, more to the feminine side of androgyny. And I was using a male name, but it didn't match my document. It was made it very awkward to go to yoga schools. There were many yoga studios that said, we really we just don't want you in our space. It's distracting. Our other students feel uncomfortable. So you have to do a certain amount of practice, many, many hours of practice to get certified as a yoga instructor. You have to be a student for a long time. Other people try a lot of different types of yoga and all this. So I'm bringing that up to say there was some trauma in the experience. I hadn't had top surgery. As a matter of fact, I got my top surgery right before I graduated as a yoga instructor. So that was hard too, because you wear very form-fitting clothes, and especially during the training, they need to see your muscle groups moving. So wearing loose baggy clothing was not an option, because our instructor really had to see, are you doing this correctly? Is it going to be safe for you to teach this to somebody else? So all that to say, it was very visible. It was obvious that I was a trans man. So I had trauma about yoga after I came. I didn't have trauma about it before. It was clear to me that yoga spaces were not trauma-informed.
We are going to take our first commercial break. You are listening to the Umbrella Hour with Dr. On and Xander Keg. Our guest this hour is Dr. Donovan Ackley III, who is a full-time research coordinator and program specialist for the San Diego State University Research Foundation. Let's take our first commercial break. We'll be back shortly.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting six crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus four biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
UK Health Radio,
the station that makes you feel good.
We are back from our first commercial break. This is Dr. On with Xander Keg. We've been enjoying our guest. Our guest is Donovan Ackley III. Dr. Donovan is an academic and has been for many years. Let's get back to where we left off.
So I was looking for something like this for a long time. And Bessel van der Kolk, his institute has developed a trauma-sensitive yoga. It's like a two-year training, something like that, in addition to being a regular yoga instructor. It's a lot more than what I do. So I just want to be upfront that that's existed for a long time. As long as he's been doing anything, he's been doing trauma-sensitive yoga. And there are instructors you can find to do that. And I've taken their classes and stuff. So it's great. It is trauma-sensitive. This, as you asked, was newer. The shooting in Las Vegas that happened in the 20-teens, the mass shooting. There was a yoga instructor who was living in Las Vegas and is a trauma survivor. Somehow she had an impulse to go out to the first responders during the crisis and teach them to ground and center. And she did that during the first day it was happening. I mean, that's how trauma recovery yoga started. She just started doing it first. And then she found it worked, and more first responders were asking her to come in and teach their community these breathing techniques and mindfulness and movement and the way she was doing it. So she developed trauma recovery yoga, which, to be completely transparent, I mean, I think it only took 20 or 40 hours of training in addition to the yoga certification I already had. So it's just, she wants to make it very accessible. So it's a very easy, it's just one standing routine, one seated routine, and one routine for children. At least the last time I've gone through the course a couple of times. But my point about that is she wants to make it accessible to anybody who has any range of movement or not. any age or not. The idea of it is, like you were saying, Xander, it's really about trauma and self-regulation, not as much about yoga. It uses yoga for that. So if you know yoga, the poses might be familiar. We're not using Sanskrit names for poses. We're not doing things in the sort of spiritual tradition of ancient yoga or anything like that. It's meant to be using neuroscience, what we know about regulating nervous system that's in trauma response, using some of these tools that work, but in a really simple way. So that's right up my alley, because it's something I can give away. I'm all about, having grown up poor myself, and then as a trans person, having lived on either in poverty or the edge of poverty ever since I came out, I'm all about, how can we help people without charging money? How can we help the most people who need it the most and have the least resources? And that's what it does. So
it makes me think of the post-traumatic growth, right? That out of tragedy can come something so beautiful, mm-hmm. right? And to, like, in the moment say, what can I do? And her thought was, I'm going to go towards the danger zone.
Exactly.
And I'm going to be with people. And I believe it was the Pulse nightclub massacre that happened here in Orlando.
Yeah.
There was a therapist who started a group for all the therapists who were being called in to do the crisis counseling. And she wanted to make sure that they had what they needed to be able to meet the needs of their clients. Her name was Eva. So she started all kinds of resources and outreach services and support services for those people in our community who were providing the therapy. Yeah. So the Pulse nightclub massacre was in June of 2016 here in Orlando. It's still something that's remembered on a regular basis here, because it's still so vividly in people's minds. As a matter of fact, mm-hmm. this morning I went to a breakfast that is meant for people who are in the mental health field. They can be peer support specialists, clinicians, doctors, drug and alcohol counselors. And it happens on the second Wednesday of every month. It was started by Eva. She's since passed away, but it still goes on month after month in order to provide that space for clinicians to come together to just take off their work hats, as they call it, and just talk about what's going on. So, like, my father died recently. So, you know, maybe that's something I want to talk about, but where do I talk about it? You can't just start up a conversation that puts people off a little bit. They get a little uneasy. And so it's a perfect place for me to be able to bring that up. And so I'm so happy that she had this idea and it's still going today.
It is. Yeah. You can look that up. They just go by TRY. Yoga, try yoga now.
I like that. I love that. That's really beautiful. Mm-hmm. You work at San Diego State University at the SDSU Research Foundation. Mm-hmm. I'll drop in here. I'm a graduate of San Diego State University. I got my master's of social work, clinical social work at SDSU in 2012. And I spent most of my life actually in San Diego. I was born and raised in Los Angeles, but my mother was in San Diego. So I went there all the time. I went to high school in San Diego. I served in the Coast Guard in San Diego. I lived there for a number of years, off and on as an adult. We came to Florida 5 years ago from San Diego. I love San Diego quite a bit. And San Diego State University is a beautiful campus. I know it's a college campus. It seems strange to say, go take a walk, but it's just beautiful on that campus. Why don't you tell us a little bit about what is the Research Foundation doing, and also this particular project that you're working on?
Well, the Research Foundation is actually part of the School of Social Work. And there are a lot of different projects and I want to say agencies, I'm not sure if that's the right word, but there's a lot of different work settings that the Research Foundation is kind of an umbrella for a variety of different labs and programs and academies and things like that. So I've actually worked in two different settings within the Research Foundation. One of them was under the School of Social Work, providing workforce training for behavioral health workers, substance use treatment workers. And I still do part-time work for them. The program that I was in, it was no longer funded by the grant that used to fund it. So that's why I moved. But I'm still doing workforce training with them, state child welfare workers and county behavioral health care workers. So I do that. And it's primarily lately they've had me come in and talk about trans, non-binary, and intersex cultural competence, you know, cultural competence for those providers in working with families who have a member who falls into those categories, or who maybe the whole family is, or whatever it might be. So anyway, yeah, so I do that. And my full-time job now, I'm in the psychology department. It's still under the Research Foundation umbrella, but I work in a particular lab with a professor who, a researcher. He does NIH and CDC funded studies with LGBTQ folks who are at risk for HIV or who are living with HIV. The work that he does focuses on wellness and at-risk communities. So I'm on two different studies right now. Both of them are NIH funded, and I'm the project manager for one of them. We're recruiting right now. So this particular one is a pilot study, so it's local to San Diego, but it is for HIV prevention for specifically for trans women and men who have sex with men. So the other one is a study for men who are living with HIV and who also use stimulants. We are about to wrap up recruitment for that one, but that's the full study. And we are trying to recruit up to 350 men across the country for that one. Now, that one's called START study, if anybody's interested in screening and seeing if they're eligible to be a participant in that. These are both community-based interventions. So one of the things I like about the work that we do here is that we work with the community to come up with community advisory boards where we pay members of the community for their time, but we're getting community input on what would be helpful as we develop. This particular doctor I work for, he likes to use mobile health interventions, real time people can just have on their phone. So trying to design those with the community and then get feedback from the community about what's working and what we can do better and things like that.
Well, that's wonderful. I do know, as a person who used to live in San Diego, that there's a large LGBT community in San Diego, and I'm sure that you have quite a large number of people to recruit from, but that doesn't necessarily mean they're all coming forward. But
right. There's also study fatigue. There's so because you have SDSU and you have UCSD here, among other things, there's a lot of folks recruiting the same community. As wonderful as this community is, it's a lot to ask. Some of these studies we recruit from around the country. So that's why I mentioned the START study. The one I'm doing that's local is called E-STEP study. Hit us up and I can send you the screener.
I'm involved with some of the HIV community organizations. So I'll mention this START study.
START study is national. E-STEP study is local to San Diego. Yeah, awesome. Thank you. Much appreciated.
Yeah, that's here in Florida.
Yeah, so. Yeah. Wonderful.
How long have you been working for the Research Foundation now?
It was actually still during the pandemic. I had been working in residential recovery doing as a drug and alcohol counselor. That's why I mentioned it earlier. That's what I was doing for several years. But residential care became a lot more challenging during the COVID pandemic. And San Diego is very expensive. So a bunch of adults living together in one place is very common. So that's what we were doing. And one of the members of the household was HIV positive. So we really couldn't afford to expose that person to COVID, right? So I couldn't work in residential care during that time. And I applied a lot of different places. Research Foundation invited me to come on board. And that was, like I said, during the pandemic, I want to say 2021, something like that.
Yeah, isn't it funny how time just gets away from us? Yes.
Well, there's just been so much change in my life, you know, in the last 10 years, it's kind of hard to keep track of everything.
Well, especially because, as you mentioned, you were pretty much on the professor track and you were going to stay there and you were going to retire. And so all of a sudden, this total disruption happens.
Yeah.
And you get sort of scattered.
There's really not been anything as sustainable as that or as steady. I work at the Research Foundation. Everything I do is funded by grants and they come and go. You know, it's not stable work.
How did you get involved in doing drug and alcohol counseling? What led you into that?
That was the only part of my life that seemed to go well after I came out. So one of the things that happened for me was that I started self-medicating. I grew up in a home where I knew I inherited a tendency toward alcoholism and addiction. So I often stayed away from that stuff. But the side effects I mentioned of the female hormones and the psychiatric medications, it was a misdiagnosis. So those medications weren't helping me. I had all the side effects and none of the benefits. So my point is, at some point I started drinking because that was the one thing I could keep down. And then that very quickly progressed toward addictive, compulsive use of alcohol. I have no shame in this. I became an alcoholic for sure. And I needed to experience recovery from alcoholism, total abstinence. That's my journey. That's just what I had to do. And so that was the part that 3 weeks after I took my last drink is when I had a new caregiver who said, you know, DSM is coming out with a new manual. And by the way, it doesn't seem like you have bipolar disorder. There's this other diagnosis I think we should explore. And it was just a ripple effect of things very quickly that changed in my life. For me, the way I lived it, it feels like it all started with, I can't drink anymore. I can't drink like normal people. So I need to put this down. So that's been the long, steady part of me. And through that is how I met other trans men and became mentored by other trans men who had similar lived experience. And, you know, again, that's how peer support became important to me. These were things that were all part of my own journey and my own healing. And all the other places where I'd traditionally gone for support, like my family or my professional network or my religious community, those were gone. Yeah, I went where the love was, and the love was in the recovery community. That was a place I could get a job. The only other work I could get, steady work, was as a security guard. Don't get me wrong. I actually love security guard work. As much as people laugh about it, I really enjoyed that. However, it doesn't pay the bills. You know, I'm a single parent and I could not make ends meet on that salary as much as I appreciated it. So I always had to do side hustle. All that's to say, I looked to the recovery community for a while to find some community and stability and work.
And there it was. You mentioned one provider said, hey, I don't think you have bipolar. There's this other diagnosis. It reminds me of how powerful it is when a person intervenes into our life, right? It says, gives us an opportunity to reframe something, or, you know, look at something differently, and or bring something to our attention that we were unaware of, right? And the true gift of that, I've had a handful of people in my life over the course of my life who have been that one person who just sort of stepped into my life at a point in time and either held up a mirror or pointed me in a particular direction or raised a particular concern or shared a particular resource with me. And it really did set me on a very different course. Each time, all the better. I'm very grateful for when people show up in our lives and show us a sign, like, maybe you should look over here. Maybe you should go over there. Maybe you should do this. It might not always be the right thing, but I love being open to that possibility.
Are you in touch with this person to this day?
No, actually, I'm not. No.
Yeah. No, I'm not in touch with any of those people either. Right. I think they just enter into our lives at a point in time and then that's it. You know, that's been my experience.
She was somewhat uncomfortable with the re-diagnosis. It was not a warm relationship. It was helpful, and I'm grateful. And I would say this, I had been seeking help from therapists about gender issues and all that from the time I was 8 years old. And also medical providers saying, my body isn't working the way that I read about in our bodies ourselves, right? It's not doing the things that supposedly it's supposed to do. And I was always told, yes, there's something abnormal about you, but don't talk about it. So this person had a new manual to work from that gave her a diagnostic criterion that she could hear what I was saying. And actually, I felt seen. It was the first time I had been told not to talk about it, but I had persistently brought it to every therapist, psychiatrist, and doctor that I'd ever seen for almost 40 years. Yeah.
We are going to take our second commercial break. You are listening to The Umbrella Hour with Dr. Ahn and Xander Keg. Our guest this hour is Dr. Donovan Ackley III. He is an academic and is a full-time research coordinator and program specialist for the San Diego State University Research Foundation. Currently, Donovan works on community-based interventions to improve the sexual health and well-being of sexual and gender minorities in the Improving Health Outcomes Through Technology, also known by its acronym IHOTT Lab, in the psychology department. Let's take a commercial break.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-lickin' good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
UK Health Radio, the station that makes you feel good.
Good. We are back from our second commercial break. This is Dr. On with Sandra Kagg. We've been enjoying our guest. Our guest is Donovan Ackley III. Dr. Donovan is an academic and has been for many years. Let's get back to where we left off.
Yeah, no, I do appreciate her. Don't get me wrong. She wrote the letter for my top surgery, so I do appreciate that very much because I, working in the yoga field, I really needed that at that time. People were just being very, it wasn't easy for other people to see someone calling himself a man who also had a body that they couldn't understand.
I can relate, though, to sometimes those people that are coming into our lives, it's the circumstances might not be wonderful. If I think back to one of the people in my life, I was 14 years old and I was mandated to a juvenile delinquency group home for girls who were juvenile delinquents. And so it was one of the staff members who was my mirror. And so it wasn't as if it was some loving member of my family, or, you know what
right,
I mean?
Right.
Somebody who was there to keep me in line. But still, to this day, I'm very appreciative of what she did. You know, you've talked about being intersex and you've also said trans man. I've known people who refer to themselves as intersex, but not trans.
Right.
And then I've met people who are trans, don't have an intersex condition but call themselves intersex. They say being trans is a form of intersex. I don't know if you've ever heard of, there was a group of trans people back in the 80s trying to popularize the Harry Benjamin syndrome, which was basically arguing that transsexuality was a form of intersexuality because instead of an endocrine disruption, it was a brain body, you know?
No, I can see that. I can see that, but it's so political.
Yeah, I was going to say it is very political. So it's actually rare for me to hear somebody use both identity labels or identifiers as intersex. And do you get any pushback from that?
Oh, yeah. I feel like I don't belong in either community. I'm just trying to be a person who's being as honest as I can about the situation in which I find myself and respectful that other people have a different experience. So I do understand most intersex people or most people born with intersex conditions stay in the gender they were assigned at birth. So most of them are not trans. There's no reason why they would have an intersectional experience with trans identity. I understand that. And some of them are very virulently opposed to trans identities. I can only imagine with compassion that if you're a person who has sort of a fullness of gender and you've been squeezed into half of what you could be and you've managed to stick with it and make a life in it and well, I know of the surgeries that many people have had that have been unconsented. And so they've gone through some physical suffering at the minimum to be who they are. So to have, I don't know how to say it. I just have compassion over the fact that maybe for some folks, it's like, look, it's hard to be this gender, but I am this gender. And I don't want to hear about people that have crossed this line. And likewise with trans folks, as you said, most trans folks do not have intersex conditions underlying that we know of. And for myself as well, and many other trans people I talk to, it's like, well, they're always diagnosing new and discovering new intersex conditions all the time. There's like 36 of them at the last time I've heard. So it's easy for me to believe that anybody that goes through what we go through as trans people or people who are non-binary or that there's something underlying that has not yet been named and discovered. It's easy for me to believe that. At the same time, I understand that that hasn't been proven and that it's not necessary. That's the thing that's really touched my heart that parents of trans kids have pointed out to me. There's no ethical reason that my child has to have a diagnosis in order to be treated like a human being. If they say they're trans, that's enough for me and this should be enough for everybody else. So I try to pull back from that too. I don't need to know if somebody has an intersex condition or not. Maybe they don't need to know.
Well, a lot of people aren't going to know because getting the testing for that is very expensive and most insurance companies aren't going to cover it unless there's some reason.
100%. You are so right. Yes, exactly. Most of us don't know. I didn't know until I was 50 years old. There are intersex conditions that you can't test for. Like the most common one, the one I have, CAH, you don't all find it in somebody's genetic code. You can find mosaicism, but which is a rare condition, but you can't find CAH. So it's really looking at sort of the symptoms somebody has, the way their body works and is formed, and if they haven't been altered, or are there records of what ways that they were altered as a child? You know, it's very hard to diagnose some of these. So I soft pedal claiming intersex as an identity, because this diagnosis has been changed in my own lifetime so many daggone times. My parents thought I was a boy. Then the doctor said I was going to be a girl. Then I had to be feminized to live as a woman. And then I was told, oh, you're a trans man. There's no physical condition, but you're just a trans man. And you have to live this way for your psychological well-being and your sobriety. And then I was told, oh, but you're an intersex person. You're not a man or a woman. So this whole experience, and that's all over the course of 50 years. And then just experiencing again and again, other people around me, people that I would have loved and trusted that I thought were just part of my life forever, like my biological family or my religious community or the educational and professional network that I'd been part of for 20 plus years, you know, no, those people couldn't take any of that journey with me. They had such big feelings about it. So all that is to say, I'm acutely aware that people have big feelings about this intersection. And in order to not cause harm to myself, sometimes in some context, I find it relevant to say, yes, I'm a person who transitioned from female to male. So I transitioned, and I'm trans, and I feel a certain identity with trans men. I feel like I'm part of the, I have that experience. And I'm a man. People take me to be a man when they meet me. They just do. And as a man, I've had children. I have scars on my body from where my breasts were moved. I nursed children. And this is hugely important to me. My identity as a gestational and nursing parent, I want to say mother. Sometimes I even feel like saying mother. It was a motherly experience in some ways that was different than the way I experienced fatherhood. I feel like I've experienced both in some ways. I don't want to overstep, but it's part of my experience. So sometimes, yes, I use those words to name my experience because my experience hasn't been simple or linear or narrow. It's been very, very broad. And sometimes I see that as a gift because I can have really deep empathy for a lot of different people with a lot of different experiences that most people haven't been able to experience. Most people's experience is more narrowly confined, not by their choice or anything, just like mine wasn't by my choice. I've been tossed around all these different gendered and sexed experiences. So I've got to sit in with all these different groups of people. And at the same time, am I one of them? I'm not one of them in an entrenched way or a narrow way, but I've shared some of the experience.
You've heard of interactadvocate.org or Interact.
Oh, absolutely. Yeah.
So I've heard variations cited as 40. And then one time I was at a conference and I heard 80. And I was interviewing shortly after that a pediatric endocrinologist, and he frowned. He wasn't buying the 80. And I thought, okay, fair enough. I just wanted validation. But who knows?
Well, that's the point right there. That's why I said somewhat years ago, I saw 36. I've seen a variety of different lists and people separate. Some of them, they'll just say, well, there's really basically only six or really basically only 12. And then each one has these sub variations. And then, like you just said, I mean, there's people that are always arguing that, well, this is, you know, PCOS is an intersex condition or hypospadias is an intersex condition. And other people say, absolutely not. No, we're not going to hear that. So yeah, the number really varies depending on how you interpret various experiences of embodiment is what is going to me, what it goes back to. I mean, I'm a human being in a body and this body's taken a lot of different forms. Of course, we all do. I think about this a lot too. From infant to now I'm getting to be, you know, an elder. I'm aging, getting to be my senior citizen years. Anybody goes through a lot of transformation. And mine's had a few more than most, but that's all. That's all I have to say about that.
I have to tell you, you look
great. I wouldn't have it any other way. When people say, what age would you go back to if you could start over? And I'm like, no, I am who I am because of what I've gone through. I wouldn't go back to any point in time.
Yeah.
Well, Donovan, it's been a real joy to have you on the show and to hear more about your life and the journey that you've made. And I'm so thankful that you were willing to come and share that with us.
Yeah, thank you.
Thanks for asking. Yeah. Good to hang out with you again.
We've come to the end of the Umbrella Hour. You've been listening to Dr. On and Xander Kagg. Our guest this hour was Dr. Donovan Ackley III, and Xander has an announcement he would like to make. Let's listen to that, and then we will bid you adieu until next time. Thank you for listening to the Umbrella Hour.
Imagine a world where you're not confined by the norms and expectations that society imposes on you. Well, in my new book, The Third Space, The Nonconformist Guide to the Universe, I take you on a transformative journey to discover and embrace your authentic self. The Third Space challenges conventional thinking and offers powerful insights and practical tools for breaking free from societal constraints. I provide a unique perspective that encourages readers to navigate life's complexities confidently and creatively, ultimately finding freedom in the third space where true individuality thrives. Whether you're seeking personal growth or a new way to see the world, this guide is your gateway to a more fulfilling and liberated life. The book is now available on Amazon. Please do write a review if you enjoy what you've read. Thank you so much.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only $10 every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.